Hi, my name is Marcus, and this is a companion podcast for the CG Jung Help Desk Meetup Group. I host live events on Zoom every 2 weeks about the concepts and ideas of the Swiss psychologist Carl Gustav Jung. Every event, I give a presentation about the Jungian concept, so have fun with this event's topic.
There it is, recording in progress. So, all right, the topic for today is alchemy and active imagination. And I want to start with telling a little bit about Jung, because a lot of what Jung has been doing and was interested in was very intertwined with his personal life. So Jung had a pretty big secret, a big chunk of his life, which was the secret work on a book, which is a red book. And he worked from it roughly from age of 38 till 51. And Jung, born in Switzerland in 1875, Swiss psychologist, thought it's so strange and so weird to work on this that he basically told no one about it. He went into his fantasies and tried to explore his inner world, and he documented his journey, and he kept journals called the Black Books, which he then brought into a single volume called the Red Book. And the Red Book was really this massive piece that he had hand-drawn and hand-written, and it was bound in red leather. That's why the Red Book. And it was basically a family secret. He showed sometimes some excerpts to his friends and his colleagues and his family, but he did not want anybody to know about it because he found it rather weird. And he worked 13 years on it, almost daily. And there, a lot of the ideas what Jung is famous for came from: the collective unconscious, the anima, the animus, the shadow, self, and so on. This whole plethora of ideas came from these investigations into his own psyche and his own fantasies and this documentation. So this was really what filled his nights. And during the day, he was a practicing psychotherapist, and he also taught and had seminars and so on. So it was a little bit like his second life that he took care of when dinner was done and he would return to his studies and spend time with himself and his psyche. And as I said, this went on for 13 years, so a really long time, until one day he got a letter and a book. And in this package was a translation of a Chinese alchemy text called The Secret of the Golden Flower. And it was translated into German from Chinese. And he read it and was completely thrilled by it. And he was asked to write the introduction for it. And he wrote it. And from this point on, his obsession with alchemy started. So he was already in the beginning of 50, and he lived a pretty long life till 1961, so roughly 85 years. So for the next over 30 years, he invested a lot of time into alchemy and alchemical texts and all the symbols and procedures and so on. So he really became obsessed. And I wrote this also in the description for this event, that this was an obsession of his. When you have the collected works, there are a lot of alchemical texts, really a lot of alchemical texts and books and everything. And when you have older stuff by him, it's pretty funny. At a certain point, he just decides to talk about alchemy. He turns into an old man that says, oh, I have some topic I'll write about. Okay, but now I will talk about alchemy. Everything comes back to it in the end. And he has his magnum opus, which is Mysterium Conjunctionis, which is a very thick book about alchemical texts, and it's about the great unification process. And a part of this very big book, Mysterium Conjunctionis, is Ion. Ion was supposed to be the chapter of it, but it became so big that he had to make it into a separate book. And Ion is pretty famous and hard book to get into, but very, very, very interesting. So, tremendous amount of work. A long, long time. Into his 80s, he wrote all those stuff about alchemy. So what did Jung find there? What caught his interest? And what did he think made it so special? This will be what the event will be about. So, starting with alchemy, it's incredibly old. We have some texts from the Greeks, or over 2,000 years old, talking about alchemy. And the word itself comes from Arabic. And it's a fun thing. You have certain words that start with al, like alchemy, alcohol, algebra. And al is in Arabic like the, in Deutsch der Artikel. So it's the chemi, the kohol, the gebra. And there already in the name is chemistry, chemi in it. And this is really this idea of having different materials and watching how they can transform and change. And this is a route for chemistry and also a lot of natural sciences. But of course, it's now pretty much disregarded to talk about alchemy as a serious science, because this idea of, okay, these alchemists, they try to turn lead to gold to become rich. And of course, this does not work. Well, you could do it, but it takes an enormous amount of energy to turn lead atoms into gold atoms. So it's an impossible endeavor. But still, people had a tradition for hundreds, thousands of years where you have had these alchemists writing about chemical stuff. It's very opaque and very hard to understand what they're trying to get at. And what Jung saw there and was of interest to him was not really this materialistic view to see materials interacting and changing, but rather a psychological view. He was a psychologist, he was a psychoanalyst. So what he saw there was a unique human product of culture. And Jung was interested in everything. Even when he was very young, he was interested in spirituality, the occult, astrology, history, mythology, fairy tales. He became interested in a lot of fringe topics. And when he got older, he even started to write about UFOs. He took everything that was a part of human experience and human artistic endeavor, cultural endeavor, extremely serious. And he saw always there is something there that draws humans to that, to these topics, to these experiences. And he wanted to explore why. So he said, alchemy, the value in it is not really the science part. And this can be disproven pretty easily, that you cannot easily turn lead into gold, but rather the psychological part. What does it say about the psyche, what they're talking about? And alchemy itself, there is no school of alchemy that he noted. It's not like there were alchemy academies or careers in alchemy. It was rather you had very isolated people, extremely isolated, who started to investigate this material and become incredibly interested in metals and acid and fumes and all those stuff. And it's more like a calling, he said, Jung, that people suddenly started to become incredibly interested and pursued this topic. Alchemists always incredibly solitude. And there's one very famous one. And that's Newton. Newton was an alchemist. And he was interested in physics also. But the foundation of physics, which Newton started off as a bet. Somebody bet some money that if somebody was able to describe the weird notion that the moons of, I think it was Venus, have, that that person would get money. So Newton worked on it for years and years. Basically to win a bet and start physics, so things you do based on a bet. But his main passion was alchemy. So he would put on his little hat and investigate all the stuff that's happening with all the weird materials. And alchemy is based on some premises which are universal to all alchemists, even though that alchemists are not really connected in a direct way. So there's, like I said, there's no schools, there's no career path. There are some very hard to understand texts in very different languages. What Jung did his life was get these texts and translate them from Latin, from Greek, from all different languages, just to know what they're about. So it's not, there's a unified language. And he noticed certain patterns. And alchemy, of course, as I mentioned, interest in the material. So it's a very outward view. It's a very view into the world, which is already strange in a sense that back then, Christianity was rather prevalent. And Christianity is very turned inward into the salvation of the soul and the spiritual experience of God and so on. And Christianity is not so much interested in the outside world, especially Catholicism. We have another tangent I have to go off on. And Catholicism is this idea of the deteriorating world. And you find it already in the Old Testament that people would get very old. Like Adam got 800, 900 years old, and Moses got 600 years old. And you had this diminishing lifetimes of the people the farther you go in the Bible. So the thinking was that the earth is deteriorating. This is why at a certain point there will be the apocalypse and everything will be setbacks to zero. And this view exemplifies this depotentiation of the outside world, of the material world. And you find it even in artistic works of Catholics like J.R.R. Tolkien. And this I found very interesting when I heard about it. He was a hardcore Catholic. He was so Catholic that he forced his fiance to convert to Catholicism so that he can marry her. Otherwise, he would not marry her. And this idea of the deteriorating world, you also find in The Lord of the Rings. Lord of the Rings being about the third age of Middle Earth. And the elves are leaving and all the great kingdoms are gone. And it's really this dying world that had a former glory. And it's just a change and a deterioration. And this is already kind of a Catholic worldview, at least back then. So as a polar opposite, the alchemists had a very strong view into the world to not discount the earthly things, but to focus on them extremely. And Jung noticed this connection to Christianity very often. And I will talk more about it once I've laid a little bit more foundation. So alchemy, outward orientated to the material world, to the things happening in the earthly realm. And this idea of all the things that happen above, outside, also happening inside in the small. So Paracelsus, which is a very famous doctor, also Swiss, who had this saying of, Gift ist eine Frage der Menge, poison is a question of the amount, who also started modern medicine by being very unconventional. He was also a very strong alchemist and wrote chemical treatises. There's an idea of having all the cosmos and all the universe you have mirrored also into the human body. So there's the idea of having everything that is outside is also on the inside and mapped, and that's a correlation there. Also, the interest of the alchemist into the material world comes from the idea that there is something in matter, something in materials and things that needs to be freed. There's a spirit. Things can transform. This is an idea of turning lead into gold, that there is potentiality in material things. And this is a foundation of natural sciences and the view or the scientific view of today, to investigate matter, to change matter and bring it into another form to make it useful, to reveal its potential. So this is already interesting that you have this start laying this foundation of modern science in alchemy, this idea of transformation. This is a lot of what we do. So we have semiconductors and they're made of sand. You have it everywhere. You have it on the beach, you have it in the desert. But if you pattern it and structure it correctly, you can have a processor, you can power an iPhone, you can send people to the moon, you can do all those crazy calculations, create virtual worlds. And I'm an engineer by trade. And I studied material science, especially for this view, that you can combine materials to create incredibly effects. Like you have, for example, materials in the world who are magnetic, and it's just a couple of them. But, and this is so cool, it's called Häusler-Legierung. You can combine other non-magnetic materials to create an alloy which itself is magnetic. And this is the beauty of science and investigating how to transform things to reach new potential, progress, and so on. And this is already codified in alchemy. And for a conceptual view is, and this goes back to this connection between alchemy and Christianity, they are acting a little bit in opposite. The idea of Christianity being that God brings salvation, and Jesus brings salvation, so that a higher power brings salvation and frees human beings. But the alchemical idea is that human beings bring the salvation to material things and the material world by freeing this potential, by turning lead into gold through transformation, which we do today by turning sand into semiconductors, as an example. So the alchemists, weird bunch, no school, they did not take any pupils, extremely solitary, and this will be important later on. So people just toiling away and looking at flames and all those stuff. So what for us is now pretty normal to accept that things are different. Just we had New Year's Eve and we have the rockets and everything, and they have different colors. This is based on what kind of metals are in there. Based on the metal, you have green, you have red, you have yellow, and so on. So today we know all this because we had all this scientific endeavor, and it becomes usual for us because we have seen it so often. It's very weird when you have no idea what's happening, but suddenly you take one material and the flame becomes green. It's a little bit like magic. And this is what alchemists did, just combining things and seeing how things interacted and seeing changes, like the flames changing the color just by taking different materials. And there was no explanation really for that. It just seemed like magic. And as they're toiling away, the alchemists, they have this idea of the opus magnum, this great work, so that they are working on something very specific and important. And this is the freeing of the material potential into the world. And the goal that is there, commonly it's referred to as gold, but the alchemist called it lapis. And this was the idea to create the lapis through the great work that they did. And of course, they documented this and tried to document it that. And here Jung noticed that there was no, on one side, every alchemist had their own terminology. They had their own symbols, their own terms, how to describe things. But when he looked at enough texts, he found commonalities between the texts, even though that they were contradicting each other. Sometimes even the alchemist contradicted himself by writing down all of this. He found certain patterns that happened so often that he said, okay, there's something here. And this is a comparative science, similar as you can do it in literature by taking, for example, works of a certain period to analyze what is common for this period, the underlying ideas. So if it's like romanticism or naturalism and so on, and you can see it also in artworks. And Jung would study all these texts and gather all this information and go into very, very detailed descriptions, which makes it hard and incredibly dry to read. But this lapis, the idea is to have this potential unleashed by combining a lot of things that are normally contradictory to each other. So the lapis had a lot of different names. As I said, the alchemists had different terminology, different symbols, and it's often referred to the godly Hermaphrodite. So to be a being which had both male sexual organs and also female in one person, to basically have a combination of this male and female in one thing. You have this one mythology for ancient Greece, where in the past human beings were one. So male and female, one being, two heads, four arms, four legs, and they're just spinning reel all the time. And the gods saw that people were too happy, so they separated them into male and female. And then they would have to spend their days finding the other part, which is a very romantic notion to say, okay, there is this other half in the world that you need to be a complete being again and to be happy again. And it's this idea of recombining this male and female together into the Hermaphrodite and to create the second Adam. So God created the first Adam. This goes back to the idea that the next part of salvation is done by human beings to create a second Adam, which is to some Christian readings of the Bible also Hermaphrodite, until Eve is taken out of his rib and then he's separated. They are separated. But before, Adam was supposed to be also Hermaphrodite. So to create something with the lapis, which is perfect, immortal, unchanging. And this is likely where this idea of gold comes from, because gold itself is also unchanging. Gold does not rust, looks always the same, which is a very unique property of a material, because most of things that deteriorate, they rust and so on, but not gold. Gold is shiny even when it's thousands of years old. So that makes it valuable because it does not corrupt like a lot of other things. Funny thing, funny note on the side, when you have gold and you have pure gold, it's not shiny. It's rather dim. Also, you can deform it with your fingers. It's rather soft material. So the reason why gold is shiny and strong is because there's a little bit of silver mixed into it. And this is pretty standard. Even if you buy very high quality gold, like gold coins, it's only 99.92% gold and the rest is silver. And to combine all those different things into one thing, a great reunification through the great work, through the alchemists and through human beings by taking material things as the highest goal. And on the flip side, there's this idea that the lapis can also be found completely not recognized. So to have something incredibly valuable, which is the goal of everything, and the work, and the end result of a tremendous work, but it is not recognized. It's not found initially. So it's like found but disregarded. And it takes a long time to be recognized as the lapis. So a lot of contradictory ideas. In the center of this magnum opus and the alchemical work is, of course, the alchemical process. So this idea of very often four things, also very important, of four things being combined. So we have this idea of earth, air, fire, water, which is coming from the alchemists and is prevalent basically everywhere. And even when you look at Pokemon, you have at first, all of those four types of Pokemon, and also popular media, especially very often child media, like there was this, the Last Airbender, also had these four societies based each on the trait of one of those four elements. But this goes further to say, okay, you have also four contradictory properties like warm, cold, dry, and humid. And you try to combine those into the lapis to create the uncorruptible, perfect, unchanging things. And Jung noticed that there are certain colors associated with the alchemical process, different stages. Alchemy is a lot like cooking, where you have different steps, where different things are important, and you're transforming through the alchemical process, through the cooking, all the material to reach an end result. And he noticed that these colors that you found in the different alchemical texts are black, white, red, and yellow. And for the people who listen to the podcast and seen the cover of the podcast, they might have noticed that these are the exact colors that I did to create a little Jung mandala with his face 90 degrees rotated to have this alchemical way in it. So there are no other ones. He points it out even. He's saying, like, okay, yeah, there's no blue in alchemy. It's just, for some reason, it's always these colors. You also have sometimes green instead of yellow, but you can argue that they are somewhat similar. So coming back to the Christianity angle, he saw the spectrum. And on the one side, it has Christianity. On the other side is alchemy, and they're complementary. He says Jung is a very big fan of compensation. When you go too far in one direction, the other direction will also automatically be generated just to keep a balance. So Christianity was this very strong view inside, disregarding the outside, created a counterbalance in alchemy, where people look rather outside. And Christianity had a very strong dogmatic view where everything is laid out. This is the world, this is how it works, and you have to believe it. This is how everything is. And we had our revelation, God talked to us, and we only have to follow this. So in Christianity, no individual revelation. There's nothing that you can do basically by yourself except talk to God, follow the rules, and so on. But it's not like these things will really happen to you. Even all the saints who had all those individual revelations first were heretic. They were seen as heretics, and very often they were killed then as martyrs. This was only then later that say, oh, okay, yeah, maybe they were saintly, maybe they were important for Christianity. And this is a big no-no of Christianity, to have this individual revelation. But there you have these alchemists who experience all those weird visions and all those weird stuff, which is individual revelation. So Jung had also this idea that they very often had to codify their work, not to be prosecuted, but because there was an operating system running and it did a pretty good job to push everything out. So on the one side, it was a very good thing for the West. Nietzsche argued that Christianity came along because it imposed one worldview that people had to learn, that gave the foundation to everything, like an operating system that everybody had. And by mastering this one worldview, you would be able to just learn the skill of acquiring a worldview and then also being able to change that view. So Nietzsche did not talk a lot about, positively about the Christian church, but he said this was this one positive thing of developing this will and laying this foundation for whole societies. But again, very strict and not so much innovation taking place, except then with the Protestants, and that basically split the church. This happened a lot later. So this is not the first time, of course, that people would have individual revelations. There were some people even earlier, and those were the Gnostics, who Jung was also interested in, and they prayed to a snake god. And Jung said they did something similar like the alchemists. The alchemists looked at the material world and had visions there, but the Gnostics, they had visions on biblical texts. So it was a little bit like fan fiction about the biblical corpus. And of course, the church didn't like that and tried to kill them and killed a lot of them and burned all the books. And a lot of stuff we have left from the Gnostics is only from Christian forefathers who discredited the Gnostics and telling what they did everything wrong. But this is now the last pieces we still have from the Gnostic tradition. And they had weird stuff like Jesus taking a disciple, going up a mountain, taking off his own rib to create a woman, have sex with her, kill her, and then tell the disciple what you want to do. And it's all the stuff that, of course, the church does not want to hear because it's a little bit too freestyle. And with these dogmas and this very strict structure that the church had, of course, the church at a certain point would decline and just power and believing. And we can see it today that the church is not this important thing anymore as it was in the past. And it's shown also in the splitting off of the Protestants and the more and more depreciation. It's also what Nietzsche talked about, the death of God, that this underlying foundation, just people lost the connection to it. Like the dogmas are there, but they are lifeless. And people find it hard to believe it and it does not match their own experience. So Jung saw in the alchemical endeavor a continuation of the Christian faith in the sense of there is revelatory information coming. But of course, as soon as you codify it, it becomes a structure and becomes dead. And like all great structures die at a certain point. If you look today into companies and you look 100 years back, the 500 biggest companies, they're basically not around anymore, even 50 years ago. It's this coming of going of big things, small things getting big, then getting small by dying. And here, Jung took those revelations of the alchemist very serious, as he took a lot of things serious. He talked to schizophrenics, people with mental disorders. He listened to people's dreams. He went into Africa and India and so on to talk to the people living there and to scholars and so on. And he saw everything as very valid. And he tried to decode a little bit the symbols that the alchemist used to explain what they're trying to get at. For example, very often what the alchemists talk about is the dragon or the Ouroboros, which is a snake which eats itself. He described it really as the brown earth and chaos, where basically everything could happen, but it does not happen. And this is the idea of the Ouroboros, that it's completely closed in itself. There's nothing going in, nothing going out. So it's just trapped in itself. Potential, again. So let's say you have this latch. This is the Ouroboros. But to open it up and let it materialize its potential, this is then the gold. And it's just a cool stuff what he found out or hypothesized, trying to find this connection between the experience of the alchemists and the symbols that they used. So, for example, he said, very often the alchemists talk about lions, especially a green lion. This thing again with yellow, green being one of the colors. He said, this acidity, this is, you can have liquids, like for example, citrus, which will destroy marble. So if you have something with marble, you should not put lemon on there because it will bite into the material. A little bit like a lion bites, like the aggressivity of the lion. And when they talked about spirits, he said, this was very often associated with water. And this is a old idea. He called it a primitive idea, that the soul is humid. And this is, again, something which is extremely empirical. The difference between a living being and a dead being is, of course, motion and breath. And when you have something breathing, which is alive, you have humidity. You can test it on any cold surface or cold window. So the idea that the soul is water comes from there, because living things seem to have a soul, which is animating them, and they are exhaling liquid, humidity. So soul, water, and so on. Blood, very often associated also with water. And of course, we're talking alchemy, we're talking cooking, the idea of the vessel, bath, or womb, right? Because in a womb, you also have things cooking. You have your stomach, which is also doing alchemy all by its own. The gold aspect, he said, is a little bit like a misunderstanding. It's not the normal gold that the alchemists talked about, but rather the sun substance. That the sun is made of a substance, which is incorruptible and perfect, and the alchemists tried to create it on earth. This is a gold they were looking for. Then they talked about the peacock's tail. If you picture it, how a peacock looks like, and the tail with all its feathers and all the colors, this often it was what they meant when they saw the different flames, when they just set fire to different things and see it burn differently, because you have now the color like in a peacock. In a peacock's tail. So these are the foundations of alchemy, just to get some basic concepts, how they view the world, the premise they were working on. So now, why was Jung so interested in that? Jung saw there a lot of psychological things happening. Because of course, when you have an alchemist and he is locked away in some cave and looking at burning metals and some flames, and he said, this is a lion eating the dragon and so on. These are visions, those are hallucinations. And the interesting thing is, the alchemists thought this is happening outside in the material world because they had the focus on the material world, but it was their own psyche being projected on it. This means all those symbols and all those procedures that the alchemists were talking about, they unknowingly talked about their own psychology. And this is what Jung did very often when he talked to people who had psychosis, schizophrenia, or had dreams, or fantasies, and so on, to take note of that and find the commonalities to find out how the psyche is working in general. And here is said the great mishappening took place because alchemy is the start of chemistry. As soon as chemistry got far enough to get results with all those alchemical nonsense, which could be easily disproven, it was put on a wayside and locked away. He said, the chemists are the wrong people for the alchemical text because it's not about material science. It's about psychology. And the value in alchemy lies in investigating psychology. The great advantage is that the alchemists themselves did not thought about psychology because there was not a concept of psychology and the psyche. It did not exist yet. So they were very naive, just writing everything down, what they experienced, to get a very unfiltered view how the psyche is working. And this is something that Jung really, really, really loved. He described that this opus that they did of generating something from the chaos, the Ouroboros, to gold, something valuable and incorruptible, as the part of the psyche that creates culture, to have unconscious potential of things that are the unconscious, which are weird and intermingled and not clearly distinguished, to bring it into the light and transform it into something useful by integrating it into consciousness. And these symbols that they're using, they are coming from the collective part of the psyche. So Jung saw this really as you have your consciousness, this is you, what you know, what you experience, what you can do, and so on. Then you have your personal unconscious, which is all the stuff about you you don't want to think about, do something about, and so on. By a certain point, you hit human nature, and that's the collective unconscious. And this is the layer in the psyche where all artistic endeavors come from. Culture comes from stories, mythology, folklore, everything. And alchemy being an additional pathway to look into what's happening in the collective unconscious and how the relationships are there. And this unification of different contradictory things, he saw really as this basic function of the psyche, of unification. This idea of you have your consciousness, which is how you are now, but how you are now is not everything you could be, but you're operating in a stable structure, but the structure is not enough because the world is endless and you are limited. So what's happening through one's lifetime is this constant death and rebirth of the ego and consciousness to create something new that becomes better and better. And this is this individuation path that Jung talked about, of integrating more of the unconscious contents out of the dark part of the psyche, out of the fangs of the dragon, to unify it in the bright shining consciousness, which is very often associated with light and the sun. And when the alchemists worked on the magnum opus to create the lapis, they would encounter figures. And there was one figure which was very often encountered, and that's Mercurius, or Hermes. He's the messenger of the gods, and he's a trickster, and he's smart, and he's the saint of tradesmen, but also of thieves, and so on. A little bit of a shady character. And the alchemists, they would encounter him, and he was like a friend. He's a messenger from the beyond, helping the alchemists. And Jung saw this as a personification of the unconscious, something he noted very often, that the unconscious can take certain personified forms, like the shadow, the anima, or the animus, or even the self, makes it possible for the conscious to interact with the person, with this personification, and in that way, with this part of the psyche. Like the anima is a way to the collective psyche, the shadow is the access to the personal unconscious. This idea of you have Mercurius, where the word curious is coming from, is amazing. So the interest is piqued by a messenger that's helping you. And you really have to look out in cities, especially older cities, how often there are statues of Mercurius. For a certain time, when I was reading these books, I was in the Netherlands a lot. And then so many buildings where you have this head of Mercurius and the wings and the staff, which is also the staff that you have at doctor's offices and so on. It's really tremendous. You will find the most insignia of a Greek god from Hermes around. And this idea of curiosity and the messenger of beyond and bringing of wisdom and helping and so on, which is really interesting. So Jung saw that really as a personification of the unconscious. So Jung saw that the alchemists were engaging in a psychological endeavor without knowing it. And the technique he described them engaging in is active imagination, which was a technique he came up with. Well, he rediscovered it basically, but active imagination, which is a second part of this marquee topic of this evening, is something very, very special to Jung. This is again this idea you have consciousness where you have light and you have the unconscious where you have basically everything potential coming from and how things change from one area into the next. And very often all these things come involuntarily. Like when you have fantasy, when you have dreams, when you have a hallucination, it's the unconscious pressing itself against consciousness. So it's a rather passive experience. But what Jung noted was you can also actively engage with these fantasies that are coming up to basically confront them on your own terms in an active way. And this is what he has done when he was writing the Red Book, to have his fantasies and bringing them into a conscious matter and engage with them consciously. He would also encounter personifications and persons that he could talk to and ask questions and get answers. And he said, okay, this is interesting. These are other parts of the psyche that I don't know about, but they have messengers and I can talk to them. And he used this very often in therapy with his patients. For example, when patients got overwhelmed by unconscious material, which was overwhelming them in a passive way, he tried to teach them how to engage with them in an active way to dim it down. And he noted when people would really actively engage with that, that this flood would subside a little bit. Because for him, always when the unconscious is pushing against consciousness, it's trying to say something, it's trying to get the attention and bring in the curiosity of consciousness to investigate. But also the other way around, when people would have no unconscious things coming up, for example, they would have no dreams, then he would try to get this communication running. So the consciousness is so removed that it does not recognize anything really happening outside of itself. Use it also very often as a concept of amplification for dream analysis. I won't go into that too deeply, but it's really this trying to generate more material to analyze from dreams. So for active imagination to do it, it's a skill to be learned. And for those people who have experience with meditation, so sitting down, closing your eyes, trying to concentrate and watching yourself, watching your mind, it's a rather hard skill to learn to just sit still and, for example, think of nothing. When you do it, it's incredibly hard because after a couple of seconds, there's a thought and then you're gone. To just keep it up for a couple of minutes is very, very skillful. It's like not moving. When you lie down and say, I don't want to move, it just takes seconds or minutes until it's unbearable and you have to move. And it's a little bit like that, to keep this focus on the fantasy coming up and really holding it still to let it speak all the things it wants to transport. And yeah, to go into it with this attitude, to do it voluntarily and actively and taking it seriously, everything that's happening there. And being free of criticism, to just accept everything. Like the alchemists did, they just accepted everything and they tried to write it down, being in this not critical phase of just experiencing everything that's happening. Doesn't matter what is happening. So this is very shortly just active imagination technique by Jung. And as you might have noticed, I tried to point out all those different commonalities between Jung and his work and alchemy, which explains, at least in my eyes, what his very big interest in alchemy was, because it was measuring perfectly his experience. Like he went into hiding to write on his book and write down his experiences. So he didn't do it with materials, but he did it with his psychology. And after working 13 years on it with the Red Book, he encountered suddenly this huge group of people who have done it for centuries and millennia and came to very similar experiences as he had. So it's a little bit like a control group. It was another way to get confirmation for all the experiences that he made. And this is where I really think he saw himself very strongly aligned with the alchemist and the alchemical experience. And he saw it later than everywhere. He talked about how Faust from Goethe, part one and part two, are also basically alchemical texts, especially the second part, which is very hard to understand, as I've heard. Which the first part is already difficult to understand, but the second part seems to be impossible unless you try to read it as an alchemical treaty. So now that I talked so much about alchemy and about Jung, and you're saying, oh, that sounds great, this sounds amazing. When you try to get into alchemy through a Jungian way, as I mentioned, there are a lot of books that Jung has written about it, and they're freely available, and they're very hard to get into because he's talking about this treatise. He's too much in detail. It's this protocol of all the things he found out when you don't know what he's really trying to get at. So when you're interested in alchemy, read the last chapter first, because in the last chapter, he will always say, oh, okay, yeah, this, and he connects it to his own theories. And this is also what I try to do here, to just give a conceptual foundation into his interest in alchemy and why he was interested and where he saw all those connections, which are for him purely psychological, with this process of individuation, of change, of transformation in oneself. He noted this creation of the perfect being within oneself to create something new. And this perfect being in his terminology is the self, which is the sum of all the things that could be possibly combined and the thing that you could potentially be if you are able to integrate everything which is not integrated. And this you reach through individuation and by bringing unification between conscious and unconscious, which he has this very big opus, this magnum opus, about Mysterium Connectonis, which is the mystery of the unification. So, incredibly dry, extremely high-level Jung. If you want to get into it, have a very strong Jungian foundation just to not fall asleep. There are a lot of interesting pictures in there, so they are pretty to look at. And yeah, so this is basically everything I could dig up in context of alchemy, Jung's view on it, and my interpretation why I think Jung was so extremely interested in it. And I hope you had fun and you learned something. And I'm very thankful and I'm amazed that so many people came for such a fringe topic, which is alchemy. This would end the presentation part.
This was this event's topic. Thanks for tuning in. During an event, a discussion part follows after the presentation where all attendees discuss the just presented topic or other Jungian concepts. If you also want to join, find the group on meetup.com. The name of the group is CG Jung Help Desk. Also make sure to subscribe to the podcast on the platform of your choice. See you next time.
I noticed during the talk when Kate, when you talked about the different colors, that I promised you all to talk about the color progression in the alchemy process. And I just want to finish this up because this was an open point that I missed. You have black, white, red, yellow. And for Jung, in an individuation sense, this was black being the unconscious, being dark, muddled, and so on. The depressed state where people would have to leave it in the process, the lapis or the material in use would lose its color and become white, because white is a loss of color, become airy and light. So it's this black earth, the white being the air, being up here, so being more intellectual, abstract, and so on. But in that process becoming too, again, too abstract to be dead. So that needs to be life, that needs to get back into the thing, for example, into the person, which is the red, the color of blood, to bring life back into this abstract part. We saw that as this libido rushing back in into a person. And he noticed this is why a lot of people who go out of a neurosis and a depression become very egotistical because then suddenly pump this all these energies that have been restricted before. And you can have inflation taking place and so on. But this is a fire aspect. And then, of course, you need this water aspect we have not talked about. Yeah. So that's the last one. But I'm not sure how yellow connects to water. And I could not find how Jung talked about this. But this is, again, this psychological process taking place, visiting different modes of being to reach a unique endpoint. And Jung had his typology, which was centered around four functions, four again, which are thinking, feeling, sensation, and intuition. And here again, individuation for him is to make all those four functions differentiated and integrated into consciousness that people can act in with them willfully to get a complete experience of the world and of experience, because it's like different pathways of information into consciousness. And if you only focus on one, you miss out all the other stuff. You only see a part of reality. And he saw those being in conflict, which is other thinking and feeling being in conflict, intuition and sensation being in conflict. And here again, it maps on this alchemical idea of you have four things of something that are contradictory to each other, but you have to unify them to create something perfect.